and welcome to The Golfing Mind, the podcast which looks at the game of golf in general, and where possible, we really focus on the mental game, that part of the game that so many people dismiss, and yet professionals will tell you with their hand on their heart, it makes up at least 80% of the professional game. So if they think it's that important, maybe we should all give it a little more attention. Well, I hope you do. And it got me thinking that in the world of golf or the world of sport or the world of competitive eating or, in fact, in any area of life where we can measure success in terms of our results from a given endeavor, then the mental game really has to be important. So what gets in the way time and time again of us performing to our best ability? And, you know, without exception, it's never lack of what I would say is technical skill. It is lack of mental management. And by lack of mental management, I mean we just find ourselves getting very stressed by a situation where we can't control our nerves. And I had a very good reminder of this. I don't play golf for a living. And to be honest, I don't write about golf for a living. I've written 3 golf books. I've got another one coming out in October this year. But I do it, I guess, as a combination of fan and enthusiast. And I feel I have something original to say, which is why I do it. Because regardless of what people may tell you, if you tell someone you're a writer, they kind of imagine, oh, that's a nice job. I wish I was a writer. But as far as I'm concerned, writing is a chore. It's like endless schoolwork, you know, and you have got these deadlines you have to meet and you're never quite sure how it's going until a long time thereafter. So writing a book doesn't necessarily come with all the joys that people might think. You know, it can in its own way be stressful. But I'm very aware that I talk about golf and I talk about the stresses and strains of golf. But as I say, I don't play it for a living, and probably neither do you. And I was reminded in my world that I inhabit professionally, I am best known internationally as a keynote speaker on the topic of peak performance, leadership, and the general theme of motivation that runs through them. I look at the creation of success cultures, why some organizations succeed, why there are some people, male and female, whoever they take control of as a manager, they get results. You get it in sport, people that can take over a losing team and turn it around in a really remarkable period of time. So what is it they're doing? So today I wanted to explore that and give you a personal example. I was booked to speak at an international conference in Lisbon in Portugal this week, just gone. And originally when they spoke to me, they said, we'd like you to give the opening keynote address and we'd like you to speak for 45 minutes and then do Q&A for 15. Now, I don't generally get many questions when I give a presentation, not because my subject or topic area is so dull that no one can be bothered asking a question, but I generally speak about what I would call principles which are inherently true. So you're not going to disagree with the principles I talk about. You might ask me about applications, but I rarely get questions. And I like it that way because my experience in the world of professional speaking, which I've done almost for 30 years now, is that if you give a speech and the purpose of the speech is the purpose of my speech, particularly is to inform, to inspire, entertain, and to energize the audience. So at the end of the talk, they've been emotionally engaged. They've heard information they didn't know, they had forgotten altogether. And you want to have delivered the content in such a way that they take action. They feel, you know, I can actually do that. And it's what I do with the people I coach in golf. I don't talk about abstract theories and say, so that's good to know, because knowledge without application is just, well, it's just knowledge, isn't it? It doesn't serve us very well. And I, you know, you can read 100 books in golf, but someone who's had three golf lessons will beat you every time. So I had to speak at this conference, so they said you'd be speaking for an hour. So I spent a few days having been given a detailed brief, and I was using quite a few new slides. I was using some new examples in my presentation. So when you're doing something new, you have to be much more alert. You have to be on top of your subject matter, because it's very easy to get into a habit of just delivering a very similar speech every time you get up to speak. Because as the old saying goes, it's probably easier to find a new audience than it is to write a new one-hour keynote that is of sufficient quality that you're very happy with it. Because you do always want to do your best, to give of your best to whoever you're speaking to. And when I arrived in Lisbon, I was informed that there was a possibility that in the first session where I was speaking, they might be running 15 minutes light, which meant that they were going to go into the coffee break 15 minutes early, which, you know, I don't think any audience in the world ever complain about going for a coffee early. But the organisers felt it was such an opportunity to have the audience together from all over Europe and America that they wanted to use that every moment they had to connect with the audience, which, you know, makes good sense to me. And they then said, well, could you do 1 hour 15? Now, I have a contract, and the contract says I'm going to speak for an hour. So I would be within my rights of saying, ooh, I'm just going to do an hour. But the truth is, you know, they've worked very hard to put this conference together. A lot of people have given a lot of time and energy for months to making this conference a success. So for me to say, oh, I don't want to do an extra 15 minutes would be, you know, churlish at best and would just be, you know, unprofessional at worst. And I said to them, sure, that's not a problem. But I said, you need to understand that just as the 20-mile mark is halfway in the marathon, not in terms of distance, but in terms of effort, so I would say that 1 hour is about halfway if you're going to do 1 hour 15, because the audience gets tired from listening. And even though they're sat and relaxed, there's a lot of information coming and they're wanting their coffee. Add to the fact that this audience had been arriving from all over Europe that morning, and that they didn't necessarily know each other, even though they work for the same company, they would probably be quite, you know, I use the word unbonded. So from my point of view, this was going to be challenging, especially when you're going to give 1 hour and 15 minutes of speaking. And I try and explain to one of the organisers, you know, a good television show is about 48 minutes plus commercials. So the attention span of an audience, from my professional experience, is around 45. And that's if you're really on top of it. You know, you can lose an audience quite quickly. So to hold them for an hour and 15 is challenging. And I'm not going to now say but I didn't find it a problem. As with all audiences, you never take anything for granted, just like no two golf shots are ever exactly the same. No two audiences, no two venues, no two events are ever exactly the same. And you would ignore that at your peril. So I was looking at my notes and looking where I could expand on the content, but keep it relevant and interesting. And I noticed the night before I was getting nervous about the talk. Now, I've spoken to audiences ranging from 5,000 to 8,000 people at one time. I've spoken all over the world to multiple industries. So I have an extraordinary amount of experience, but I was still nervous because it was that new content, new this, there was a lot going on. So I suddenly thought to myself, okay, I need to apply the lessons I teach people about staying in the moment, staying calm. And I was going through one of my files on my computer, and I came across a quotation. And the quotation comes from a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. And I'm sure you might have heard of this fellow. His name's Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh, he was a peace activist, and he was a Zen Buddhist monk. And he wrote some amazingly digestible books on the subject of mindfulness. And one of his quotations was, when you are washing the dishes, be washing the dishes. So it was all about giving your attention to the present moment. So I'm looking at these notes and I came across a quote of his that I had written down. And the quote very simply says, smile, breathe, and go slowly. Isn't that great? Smile, breathe, and go slowly. And that became my mantra for going forward. So the next day I arrive at the event, I come into the room, I get the microphone on. It's a big room. There's a large audience. They're spread out. The room is very quiet. The first person gets up, opens the conference, then goes on one of the executives. Then there's another presentation, and I'm due to go on at 10 past one and speak. Sorry, I'm due to go on at 10 past two and speak until 10 past three. And I suddenly see the clock coming to 1:45, and the person in front of me is wrapping up. So I'm now going to go on 25 minutes earlier than planned. And I had said to the organisers, I will not do more than 1 hour 15. It's just too long for the audience, and it's too long for me. I'll run out of energy, and that's not great. And that was that. So I reminded myself, smile, breathe, and go slowly. So rather than bounce onto the stage like Tigger from Winnie the Pooh and bouncing around with manic energy, not that I do that normally, I walked on a little slower than normal, placed my notes on the podium, and started to talk. Now, the audience was quiet, but responsive. And as I'm talking, I realized that I was smiling. I realized that I was breathing quite consciously and I was not racing. Because when we get anxious, especially when you're giving a speech, what you want to do subconsciously is get the speech over and done with and get off the stage. Now, that's not always possible, and particularly when you have a speech that's going to go for 1 hour 15, you can't speed through it in 40 minutes and expect anyone to remember anything about it. But the thing that was overwhelming to me is I know in my professional life, in the past, this kind of thing would have been very unsettling, and I'd have got a very sticky, dry mouth. I might have been a little sticky in my speech pattern. But I concentrated entirely in smiling, not grinning like an inane idiot, obviously, but just having a smile on my face when I looked at the audience. Breathing, being very conscious that I was breathing and going slowly, so staying in the moment. And the speech went fine. In fact, when I got to 1 hour and 5 minutes, there was a sort of signal from the a monitor. There's a clock monitor that lets you know there's 10 minutes to go. And I easily could have gone on for another 40 minutes. And it was a really, really good reminder to me that when we're under pressure, more than ever, we need to breathe. And when we smile, and there's a science behind the smiling, when you smile, the muscle memory of the muscles you need to smile are used when you're happy, you're laughing, you're joyful, you're in a good mood, you're very content. So when you replicate a smile on your face, even though you may not be feeling any of those things, the biofeedback to your body is, yes, these muscles are activated when I'm in a state of relaxation, happiness, joyfulness. And I mean, you can try now. I mean, if you're by yourself in a meeting, listening to this on headphones or driving your car, just take a big smile. Don't open your mouth and show your teeth, but just a big closed mouth smile. And when I think of that, I think of Victor Hovland. He's always smiling. I'm sure he's doing it quite naturally. He's not forcing it. But I found that by smiling, it made me feel relaxed so I could control my breathing. and by controlling my breathing and feeling relaxed, I was able to go slowly. So I cannot recommend enough remembering that experience I had going forward. And I was very keen to share it with you because, look, there's a huge difference between the theory practice gap. I write and research a great deal about the mental game of life and business. And for this podcast, golf, I am fascinated why some people succeed when more talented others fail. I'm amazed at how some people achieve extraordinary things. And yet to look at them, you think, well, how did they do that? What was going on? And it comes down to often very, very simple things done well. And I do think amongst that toolkit, the big things are to smile, to breathe, and to go slowly. Wherever you find yourself, in an interview, in an awkward situation, in a personal conversation, breathe, go slowly. I was watching some of the early events from the DP Tour and from the PGA, and I couldn't help notice in the first event, Rory McIlroy three-putting from 2 feet. Which is reassuring, isn't it, really? If he can do it, then I think we can give ourselves a bit of slack. What's interesting is when they miss the return, but often they're, as Brian Harman said, you put a good stroke on the putt and you wholly expect it to go in. Tom Watson was from 4 feet in the early days of his career, just absolutely ruthless. And the number of times you see a putt of Tom Watson's from 4 feet hit the back of the hole. So it's traveling. And if he missed it, it was 4 feet past and he'd make the return. And I guess when you read the biography and the life story of many of the great golfers of the past 100 years, the first thing to go is the short putts. And when you get tight over a short putt, then it becomes harder. And if ever there was an occasion to smile, breathe and go slowly, I think the short putt could be one. So my tip for this week, for you all going forward, is try it. Just try this, please. Try to be conscious that you're smiling. You know, when I travel a great deal, I come from Glasgow in Scotland. And in Scotland, and maybe in Britain, we're very, not territorial, but everyone goes out of their way not to invade other people's space. And in Glasgow, when I was a young guy, looking at somebody, what they consider to be the wrong way, would be enough for an argument, an altercation, or even a potential punch-up to evolve. The famous words of, "What are you looking at?" I can remember being said to me more. I remember once being in a cafe, never forget this. I was sitting drinking, I don't know what I was drinking, a cup of tea or a lemonade. And there was a guy, much older than me, sitting about 4 tables away, and a very lived-in face. It was almost photogenic because it was so lived-in. And I looked at him a couple of times, just looking at his face, and he just stared at me and said, "Son, do you want a photograph?" And I said, "No, sorry, I was daydreaming." And he went, "Aye, well, watch where you're looking." So I grew up in a culture where you don't invade people's, you know, their space, even visually. And when I was traveling, particularly in Asia, I found when I was in Thailand particularly, if you caught someone's eye, their immediate reaction was to smile back at you, just to smile at you. And then you reflexively smile at them. And I saw this in Malaysia. Some countries you don't get it. I didn't see it. Well, I won't mention the countries you don't get it. But there's some... Russia. Okay. I once was in Russia for 3 days at a conference in a nice hotel. And I took a bet, a $100 bet, that I could make a member of staff smile in this hotel. And I lost the bet. No matter how big a smile you gave them, there was a stare. They just gave you the 1,000-yard stare. It was the weirdest thing. I'm not blaming Russians for not smiling, but that was my experience about 18, 20 years ago. And but what I've learned to do since then, if I catch anyone's eye in the street, in the gym, anywhere, not in a bar, I would say not in a bar, not that I'm in bars that often, my first instinct is just a smile. Not a big smile, just a, you know, turn the corners of my mouth up, a little smile, a little nod of the head. And it is very disarming So I think smiling is a very good tool to have in our box. And that's it, really, for this week. Next week, I will have some guests. And going forward this year, we'll be trying to answer a few questions and interviewing many more golfers this year to get some good interviews to find out what's going on. Now, at the end of every podcast, I always say, if you're really serious about improving your mental game, then I have an online academy, seagergolf.com. And there'll be a link in the podcast description, and that will link you to it. The first lesson is free. You can learn a language, and you can learn to play cards, and you can learn new skills. You can learn to train your mind. You really can. And the competitive advantage it gives you will be noticeable quickly. Most people imagine they're mentally tough or they're good under pressure, just like most people think they can read the news or they could be a radio announcer, because the people that do it make it look so easy. But I trust me, if you're reading the news, you'll have two earpieces in, people talking to you whilst you're speaking, and you're then having to coordinate lots of different things, or at least that's what it was when I worked in television. Experts make things look so easy that you think you could do it. My father always said it was the difference between Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire. He always felt Fred Astaire made dancing look so easy that you could do it, but Gene Kelly made it look so hard you knew you couldn't. Go make of that what you want. But I would definitely really encourage you to give yourself the best chance to improve your skill set by developing a stronger mental game. And I have a 13-week program, and we have a money-back guarantee that you will see four or five shots per round come off even before you're halfway through the 13 weeks. And if you finish the 13 weeks, you'll have a toolkit and a muscle memory that will serve you very, very well. So there's a sales pitch for today. And as I say at the end of every week, wherever you are in the world, I wish you the best, and may you play good golf wherever you are. And don't forget to smile, to breathe, and to go slowly. Until we meet again, all the very best.